The view from the inside.
What's likely to be included in a deal to raise the federal debt ceiling?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Today is Thursday, the 16th day of June.
Coming up, a deal to raise the debt ceiling and cut spending is expected in the next 2 weeks. We'll find out what's likely to be in the deal from someone who's been in on the negotiations.
We're going to find out just why global investors are so concerned about what's going on in Greece.
And another problem for the Postal Service, this time from someone, or rather something, they thought they could trust.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Let's begin today in Washington, where the bipartisan group of lawmakers led by Vice President Joe Biden will meet again in search of a deal to raise the nation's debt ceiling and cut spending. The group is hoping to reach some sort of deal by July 1st.
Diane Swank has just been in Washington, and she's been meeting with the power players in the debt debate. She's chief economist with Mesirow Financial, and she's with us now, as she is every Thursday. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Diane, take us inside these negotiations. Are you expecting a deal, and what do you think will be in it?
There will be a deal, but it won't be written into legislation. There's just not enough time to write it into legislation, but there will be something on paper that is tangible, that they get enough cuts in it to actually raise the debt ceiling. And I do believe they're going to be working on, as we come back in September from their August break, they're going to be working on a long-term deal for deficit reduction, which all the outline of that is going to be in this preliminary deal.
And when you say it's not going to be actually written into legislation, do you mean that it's not going to be a real deal? It's just accounting tricks and delayed payments and stuff like that, or is this the real thing?
No, this is actually the real thing. They really are committed to doing something real this time. It's not California and just accounting tricks. This is actually the real McCoy. The problem is, hammering out the details, but they are really getting very close. I think on the short-term stuff, they're within billions of each other. I mean, when you're talking about trillions, 10 or 15, 20, even 30 billion ain't that much. So they are getting very close. They still have, and they are moving on both revenues, reforming the tax code, and on entitlements. So far, they've yet to touch Social Security, but they are going after Medicare to give the states more flexibility there. And I think they're going to get where they need to go. And in September, when they come back, I think we're going to start to see some real movement on real deficit reduction, because frankly, the rating agency said, we've had enough. It's time to get your fiscal house in order.
Interesting stuff. Diane Swank, chief economist with Mesirow Financial, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, as Diane just mentioned, dealing with the long-term debt problem in Washington is almost certainly going to involve changes to entitlement programs, and that could have big implications for the future of retirement in America.
For more on that, let's bring in Marketplace Economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, I imagine retirement could end up looking pretty different in America down the road.
Well, forget the RV, enjoying yourself in the sun. If you're going to sum up the future of retirement in America, there's only one word to describe it: bleak. I mean, look, we're cutting back on Social Security. We're going to cut back on Medicare. And yet McKinsey and Company, the blue chip consulting firm, its survey says that the average American household is $250,000 short of what it needs for a comfortable retirement.
Wow.
Do you know what the average 401k balance is, Jeremy?
What?
It's $58,000. And then there's that recent study that came out. It was a survey. But half of American households couldn't come up with $2,000 within 30 days in an emergency. So here's the mantra when it comes to retirement. It is save more, work longer.
And a lot of the money that we are saving in our retirements, for many people, goes into their 401ks. Can 401ks be the primary retirement savings vehicle?
Well, at the moment, it is our primary retirement savings vehicle. It was never designed to be that way. It was really to be a supplement to the traditional pension, the one that is a formula based on years of work and what your wage was, and then you get a check for the rest of your life. But that's what we've got, because you know what? In Washington, there's no stomach for a universal plan or some sort of mandate. Yet the experience of the past three decades is that we don't really know how to invest. The 401k puts too much responsibility on us, but we're stuck with it.
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Today, the Senate Banking Committee will look at a bill that would increase how much money credit unions can loan to businesses. Now, credit unions say a lift in their lending cap could help create badly needed jobs. From Washington, here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
Right now, credit unions' business loans are capped at about 12% of their assets. They want Congress to more than double the amount of money they can lend. John McGill is the chief lobbyist for the Credit Union National Association, a trade group. He says if the cap were lifted, $13 billion would be available immediately, money small businesses could use to create tens of thousands of jobs.
With high unemployment, the need for small business lending, we think the time is absolutely right for this.
But small business loans can be risky. Think about how many restaurants you've seen fail.
Don't let your friend start a restaurant. It's a really good way to go bankrupt.
That's Bill Black, a former banking regulator now teaching economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He says credit unions don't have the experience to deal with risky small business loans. But lobbyist McGill says credit unions can only lend to their members, and they know their communities. Congress is weighing the arguments with bills pending in both houses. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Well, the cable TV industry is in Chicago today for its annual get-together. And this year, the big threat to the industry isn't the internet. It's the cost of cable. Sally Herships reports.
This statistic is getting a lot of play this week at the cable show.
The bottom 40% of U.S. households have already exhausted their disposable income.
Mark Robichaux is editor-in-chief of Multichannel News.
So there's not a whole lot left for clothing or for cable. You can't have a business if people can't afford your product.
That hasn't stopped the big cable operators from raising prices. Robichaux says the average subscription costs 30% more than it did 5 years ago. Kartik Hosanagar teaches internet media at Wharton. He says some cable industry execs have talked about offering lower cost options, but so far there's been little action.
It might change in the distant future, but it's not going to happen in the immediate future.
Hosanagar says first cable companies will need to accept that the old model is in danger. This week's downbeat meeting may have signaled a first step. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Steve, how much do you pay for cable?
Oh, gosh, it's well north of $140 a month.
It seems to me to be a lot of money. But then again, you know, something comes on you want to watch, you got to pay it. Well, you know the box that you use, the probably HD DVR box that you have on the top of your TV?
Yeah.
Well, the Natural Resources Defense Council came out with a report this week that says that those boxes consume more than half the energy of a new refrigerator.
Wow.
And in fact, they use most of that electricity when you're not even using them.
Wow. Just while it's just sitting there.
That's right.
Yeah. Fewer people sought first-time jobless benefits last week, Jeremy. This is according to the Labor Department, out with its report today, its weekly report. And groundbreaking on U.S. homes got a bump in May as housing starts hit a five-month high.
If you like what you hear on the Midday Update podcast, let us know on Twitter. I'm at Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm at Radio Chio. Out of the marketplace, global perspective, worry continues to spread that Greece will not be able to pay off its debt. And because of that, investors fear another European banking crisis could be on the way. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from our European desk with the latest. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
All right. A government defaulting isn't that rare, Stephen, especially for a small country. Why is the Greek crisis having this continued global effect?
It's all about interconnectedness. As a member of the Eurozone, Greece is joined at the hip with other heavily indebted Eurozone countries, Portugal, Ireland, Spain, Italy. And between them, they've borrowed more than $3 trillion, much of it from European banks. So the fear is a Greek default could be the first domino to fall. Here's Peter Tal Larsen of Breaking Views.
The danger is that a Greek restructuring prompts people to start getting worried about the debt of other Eurozone countries, and that then you have a sort of potentially a vicious spiral that affects the confidence in the banking system.
The banking system. But Stephen, this is just European banks. Why the global reaction?
These European banks have got big links with US and Asian banks. It's all about confidence. And some analysts are saying a Greek default could trigger such a widespread loss of confidence that it would be rather like the freeze in lending after the collapse of Lehman Brothers 3 years ago.
When the credit dried up. All right. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Steve.
Now to the flurry of companies going public right now. The American luggage maker Samsonite joined the list today, but its initial public offering isn't happening in New York. It's happening in Hong Kong. The BBC's Andrew Wood tells us why.
The city's had the world's hottest stock market for IPOs over the past 2 years, but investors are increasingly worried about economic trouble in China. Timothy Parker is the chief executive of Samsonite, but he's not concerned about the company's prospects.
I think there are price pressures in China, but certainly we're not seeing any reduction in the level of growth of our sales at the moment. And of course, you know, everybody in China is travelling more and more, and every time they travel, they need, guess what? Luggage.
Samsonite's disappointing debut raises questions about Prada's Hong Kong IPO next week. The Italian maker of luxury goods is raising more than $5 billion through its Hong Kong flotation. But some local investors worry that they'll have to pay Italian tax on dividends and profits if they sell the shares, as there's still no tax treaty between Hong Kong and Rome. In Hong Kong, I'm the BBC's Andrew Wood for Marketplace.
There's a big economic forum going on today in St. Petersburg, Russia. It's being called the Davos of Russia because of all the political and economic bigwigs that are showing up there. Now, the event is an opportunity for Russia to market itself for international investment. And this year, there's a lot more focus on opportunities in the East than in the West.
Reporter Peter Van Dyke is at the forum, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, Peter, set the scene for us. What are people talking about there this year?
The big news this year is a potential gas deal with China. Hu Jintao, the president of China, is the guest of honor this week, and the Kremlin loves to announce big business deals here. This year, though, there's been a slight hitch. The marquee deal was meant to be a contract for Russian gas exports to China, but Russia wants higher prices than China is prepared to pay. It's not clear that the deal will get done in time for Hu Jintao's appearance with President Dmitry Medvedev tomorrow.
So everyone's talking about this deal with China. What about U.S. companies? Are they in the mix this year? Does anybody care?
Well, of course they are, because President Medvedev is openly keen for U.S. high-tech firms to bring their expertise to Russia. Google's Eric Schmidt is a star name here, as well as the CEOs of Cisco and aluminum giant Alcoa. The biggest news everyone's waiting for, though, is the launch of the Russian Fund of Direct Investments. Russia very much wants to encourage international investors, and the government is willing to go halves with them on any investment. There are $2 billion up for grabs this year.
Reporter Peter Van Dyke at the annual St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Oil's trading at about $95 a barrel today. Saudi Arabia is moving ahead with plans in the near term to increase supply and help keep prices more in check. But a new report this morning says the longer-term answer to meeting global oil demand won't come from the Middle East, but rather North America. Marketplace's Jeff Horwich reports.
The International Energy Agency says a stronger and faster-than-expected economic recovery in China and India is pushing global oil demand up. It expects prices to stay on the high side, around $100 a barrel. The IEA's David Fife presented the report this morning in St. Petersburg.
We basically see a tighter oil market than we were expecting. Higher prices is prompting a response from the supply side.
The higher price of oil means more expensive ways of producing it start looking more attractive. And this is where North America comes in. Oil analyst Samuel Chishuk with IHS Energy says most Middle Eastern and other OPEC countries are running out of spare supply. But the U.S. and Canada have some options.
In the U.S., it is a continued development of the Gulf of Mexico, but also, you know, potentially a new frontier sort of being targeted for exploration in sort of Arctic zones.
In Canada, the IEA predicts the environmentally contentious process of oil sands mining will be a critical part of meeting global demand. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
Last week, Google famously paid tribute to the late guitar giant Les Paul's birthday on its homepage. You remember this?
Yeah, last week everybody was talking about
the Google Doodle, right? So the Google logo was transformed into the look of guitar strings. And you could go with your cursor and make different noises and songs
play
with
the guitar.
You can play the guitar, right? And soon versions of everything from Freebird to Stairway to Heaven started popping up on YouTube. Well, now this website, Extreme Tech, Jeremy, says that all that music making that people were doing, right, millions of people going online and spending extra time on that Google homepage, well, that cost the world more than 10.5 million hours of work.
I don't think that's going to convince Google not to do it again, though.
Well, I think they love people checking out their site.
That's right.
Do
you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
There's a Senate committee hearing this week looking at whether the U.S. government should buy controversial crude oil from the oil sands of Canada. And those lawmakers want to know how that oil will affect the environment. If Washington says no to the deal, Ottawa then could threaten to sell the oil to China instead. From the Canadian oil sands in Alberta, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
At Canadian oil company Cenovus, executive Drew Zickel-Gansberger knows that the U.S. is his chief market. And that's rough, since Americans are debating if Canadian crude is environmentally too dirty.
So right now we're standing on a well pad.
Zickel-Gansberger's answer, nah-uh.
And these trees around this well pad will never get disturbed because we're extracting the oil sands from underneath.
Critics say, yeah, but pumping Canadian oil takes lots of energy and therefore carbon emissions. Some argue it's the dirtiest oil on the planet.
The U.S. has some choices to make, whether they still want us to access their market. At the same time, though, we are also looking at other markets.
Like China. Political? No, it's rational business. For the next two decades, Asia will be the growth market. In fact, Canadian oil already goes there, industry consultant David Goldwyn.
Canada already has a Western export line, which brings oil by pipe to the West Coast. Oil also moves by rail.
More pipelines and deeper ports are under discussion in Canada, all going west.
We need to participate in global growth markets, not singular, stagnant markets.
That's Calgary economist Peter Terzakian. And yes, stagnant market is you and me. He figures U.S. demand peaked 5 years ago.
It is permanent. You can see it in the data. People are starting to drive a little bit less. And then importantly, people are buying more commonsensical vehicles.
Canada's China card is meant to provoke an emotional response. But economist Phil Verleger doesn't worry. He says if China buys Canadian crude, we will simply go somewhere else. And he thinks the risk of a big supply disruption is overdone.
The United States has a strategic reserve of 720 million barrels of crude oil, which provides us more security than we need for almost all occasions.
Whether that's right or not, one thing is clear. More of the world's oil will flow to Asia. In Alberta, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
And finally, Steve, as if the U.S. Postal Service needed any more problems, in Dutch Harbor, Alaska, two post office customers were attacked last week.
Hmm.
Attacked by bald eagles.
There are a lot of those up there,
yeah,
aren't there? Well, maybe
out,
not enough. I don't know.
Well, it turns out that a pair of the birds, which, by the way, weigh up to 15 pounds
wow.
and have an 8-foot wingspan, are nesting right near the post office, and they've been dive-bombing customers in order to protect their chicks. They think the customers are coming a little too close for comfort. Well, authorities, though, say they have no plans to move the nest and probably no plans to change the post office logo, which, as you know, is a picture of a bald eagle.
maybe that's what drew them to the post office.
Perhaps,
in the first place. They saw, hey, that's mom.
But then you really must say they have no gratitude for all that publicity the post office has been giving them. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
Maybe they could, like, fly with mail.
Carrier eagles. There you go.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for joining us today. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.